Today's program has been brought to you by Cabaret Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are Groundworks, Inc. We design, build, and maintain gardens in New York City and the surrounding area. And We Dig Plants brings the culture to horticulture.
It sure does.
So today, with Valentine's Day just a few short days away, it's a kind of flower revolution for our topic today. And our guest is on the forefront of that cause, Deborah Prinzing, author of the new book, Slow Flowers, joins us today. One of the first photos in her book is Deborah holding a bucket of fresh flowers from the farm, and there it's a bucket of dahlias.
Yep.
And as dahlias are Carmen's favorite flower, we thought we would honor the person responsible for giving the botanical name dahlia on our horticultural honor roll.
Thank you, Joe. Now, many of you know what a dahlia is, but in case you don't, dahlia is a genus of bushy, tuberous, herbaceous perennial plants native mainly to Mexico, but also Central America and Colombia. The dahlia is a member of the aster family, and some related species include the sunflower, the daisy, the chrysanthemum, and the zinnia. There are at least 36 species of dahlias, and there are over 20,000 hybrids. They're grown all over the world now, and they're great. Now, a lot of sources state that the name dahlia was bestowed by Carl Linnaeus to honor his late student, Anders Dahl, who was the author of Observation Botanicae. However, according to my research, Linnaeus died in 1778, and that was more than 11 years before the plant was introduced into Europe in 1789. So this is
a little sleuthing.
Yes, botanical mystery to be solved. So while it's generally agreed that the plant was named in honor of Dahl, who had died 2 years before, Linnaeus could not have been the one who named it. So who was it? Well, scholars think that it was probably Abbe Antonio José Canavilles. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Who should be credited with the attempt to scientifically define the genus, since he not only received the first specimens from Mexico in 1789, but he named the first three species that flowered from the cuttings.
Thank you, Watson.
Yes, okay, quite. So today we honor Antonio José Canavilles. Canavilla, I just wanted to say that. Canavilles.
It rolls off the tongue.
It does so nicely. Canavilles was born in Valencia.
Valencia.
And was a clergyman as well as a botanist, of course. He was one of the first Spanish scientists to use the classification method invented by Carl Linnaeus. And after study and work in Paris, he returned to Spain. And in 1801, he became the director of the Royal Gardens of Madrid. So how did Canavilles get his dahlia tubers? Well, this is the most interesting part of the story, I think. In 1787, the French botanist Nicolas-Joseph Thierry de Monneville was sent to Mexico to steal the cochineal insect, which was valued for its scarlet dye. Those cardinals, those Spanish cardinals, needed a lot of red dye for their voluminous robes.
For their Roman robes.
Their robes. So he reported this strangely beautiful flower that he saw growing in a garden in Oaxaca in 1789. So, Vicente Cervantes, the director of the Botanical Garden at Mexico City, sent these weird plant parts to the abbe, Canavilles, and Canavilles flowered one of the plants that same year, and then a second one the year later. So, in 1791, he called the new growth dahlia after Anders Dahl, and I am eternally grateful for Canavillas for believing in that little brown shriveled tuber, because if anybody knows what a dahlia looks like, it looks like a...
It's magnificent.
The flower's magnificent, but the root, the tuber, is a shriveled... It looks like a... Like a cartoon cigar, yeah, you know? Yeah. So it takes a lot of faith to plant that and yeah, expect a dahlia to come out of it. So anyway, but let's get back to the 21st century and our modern flower industry. But before we introduce our guest, I kind of want to share with you guys some statistics about about the flower industry in time for Valentine's Day. This data comes from a website called aboutflowers.com, which is a floral industry website. Mm-hmm. Now, according to that site, floriculture items sold at retail outlets in 2012 totaled $27.8 billion. That's a lot of money, you know. That includes all the cut flowers and flowering plants as well. In 2012, according to the floriculture crop summary, retail flora shops, there were 15,307 retail flora shops. Their estimated average annual sales was about $362,000. Floral wholesalers only totaled 530. Domestic growers in the top 15 states totaled about 5,419. But fresh flower growers were only 280. That's right, a very small number for a multi-billion dollar industry.
Right.
You know, another interesting statistic I found was that imports account for about 64% of fresh flowers sold by dollar volume in the U.S., right? They come primarily from Colombia. 78% come from Colombia and 15% from Ecuador. Mm-hmm. In terms of our U.S. fresh flower cutting states, the top state is California with 76% of the business and Washington State, 6%. And the final statistic I thought I'd share is the estimated number of roses produced for Valentine's Day in 2013 equaled 233 million stems.
Wow.
Which is extraordinary. So today's guest is going to shed some light on a new movement that's trying to bring the cut flower business back to the United States and making things local. Her name is Deborah Prinzing. She is a Seattle and Los Angeles-based outdoor living expert who writes and lectures on gardens and home design. She has a background in textiles, journalism, landscape design, and horticulture. She's a frequent speaker for botanical gardens and horticultural society and flower show audiences. Deborah is a regular radio and television guest. She is the author of Slow Flowers by St. Lynn's Press, The 50-Mile Bouquet, Stylish Sheds and Elegant Hideaways for Clarkson Potter, and she won a Garden Writers Association Gold Award book about the abundant garden, which was published in 2005. Deborah is a contributing garden editor for Better Homes and Gardens, and her feature stories on architecture and design appear regularly in the Los Angeles Times home section. She writes for top shelter and consumer publications, including Country Gardens, Sunset, Garden Design, Organic Gardening, and Horticulture. Deborah is also past president of the Garden Writers Association, and she serves on the board of the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, which is a farmer-to-florist cooperative. In 2014, she launched slowflowers.com, a free online directory to help consumers find florists and designers who use American-grown flowers. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi there, you guys. It's great to hear from you.
Well, thank you for calling in.
You bet.
So,
how do you define slow flowers?
Yes. Let's start from the top.
Where do we start? Let me have a cough here for a minute. Excuse me. Oh, my goodness. Thank you for that introduction, and you want me to just talk about what slow flowers means to me?
Yes, yes, please.
Well, I think a lot of people know the term slow food, and then, of course, we start seeing the word slow put in front of all kinds of things, like fashion, and someone has a site called Slow Art, but, you know, these ideas of putting slow in front of any term somehow conveys a different philosophy or approach to the subject, and when I say slow flowers, I have two meanings. One is that I'm making a conscious choice about choosing flowers, my blooms, my buds, my leaves, my vines, my pods, in season, where I live. Mm-hmm. Not, for example, grown and brought in from elsewhere in the world, you know, during the wet, cold winter months in Seattle, where I am right now. I also think there's sort of this artisanal, anti-mass market approach to the word slow that you know, allows us to perhaps live in the moment and appreciate nature. And I think that you see that in the food industry as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly enough, the founder of Heritage Radio Network,
Patrick,
started the slow food movement here in the United States.
Patrick Martins. You might know him,
Martins.
Deborah.
Well, no, but I'm aware of that. And the slow food people have really recently invited flowers into their conversation, and they asked me to write an article for their newsletter this month, so it'll be out soon. I'm really thrilled.
Yeah, because, you know, flowers can sit on a table as well. It's not just all about the food.
Well, flowers are kind of the forgotten part of American agriculture, so that's one of the things that I'm trying to advocate for.
Right, right.
So how did you flip that switch over? How did you go from being sort of, in your book you say you're an observer, you're a journalist by training. How did you become an evangelist for the cause?
Well, I mean, you guys are evangelists too, so you know you can get something under your skin and you can't let go of it. But number one, I'm a gardener, and I've been a gardener for more than 25 years, and actually my early flower memories come from my grandparents. I had both my grandfathers were flower growers, and
really?
I don't know. Yeah, somehow skipped a generation with my parents. But my grandfather on my mother's side was a prize-winning dahlia grower in Indiana, and my paternal grandfather always had this peony patch in his Illinois backyard. And so somehow I think, you know, let's give them credit.
yeah.
But also, I'm a professional communicator. So once I stumbled on the untold stories of American flower farmers, which mm-hmm. was around 2006, 2007, I was totally drawn into their world and seduced by the story of what's happening with our flower industry. And
it's radically changed in the past 50 years. A few years ago, one of our first seasons, we had Amy Stewart on. She wrote that book, Flower Confidential.
Absolutely.
Do you remember that?
Yes. Yeah. Amy actually wrote the foreword to the 50 Mile Bouquet. I feel like I picked up where she left off and carried the torch that she started burning.
Good.
Yeah. So tell us about 50 Mile Bouquet. I love stories, and Alice does too. We love to hear about people, you know, real
right.
people stories on this show. Tell us about a grower that particularly touched you, their story.
Well, the 50-mile bouquet is kind of a play on the 100-mile diet, which is, again, a food thing. And mm-hmm. we were kind of using that as a metaphor. And believe me, I had so many people say, is that a rule? And I'm like, no, it's just a suggestion.
People are so literal.
Exactly. But this idea of shortening our flower mile, just like we want to shorten our food mile.
Right.
But there were lots of stories, but and all compelling. But I love Tara Cola's story. Tara owns Silver Lake Farms, which is in Los Angeles. She had a little half-acre urban backyard where she was growing sweet peas, which I have to say is sort of the starter drug flower for many people who
yeah.
you know, get into cut flowers.
Yeah.
So she was taking bunches of her luscious, romantic heirloom, you know, Los Angeles-grown sweet peas to her local farmer's market, wowing the regulars. She did this for a couple years. And then a disgruntled neighbor reported her to the Los Angeles City Zoning Department.
Oh,
and
God.
She was shut down. And it was all because this, I'll try to make this short, there was this vintage law on the books that said, that dated back to the 1940s, that said anyone who was growing a backyard crop to sell around, you know, neighborhoods, and this was back, you know, post-World War II, people were doing this, that it could only be edible crops. And this is obviously a bully tactic, but
right.
rather than give up, Tara chose to fight. And luckily she had a background in publicity and marketing. So she drew on those tools to right the wrong, and she launched the Food and Flowers Freedom Act and got all the urban gardeners in L.A. on board with her, and they lobbied City Hall, and it took 2 years and a lot of hardship, but they prevailed. She actually grew microgreens for the farmer's market, which was edible, obviously, an edible category. She did that to support herself while she was fighting the flower law.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a big loss of income.
Oh, totally,
yeah.
So today, Silver Lake, she prevailed in 2011. So in the last few years, she's just been blowing up the flower industry in L.A. at several markets. People hire her for, you know, organic weddings, and she's doing great. But she, you know, she's tenacious. You know, most of us would have given up.
No, you
so
have
that was
to
one
be,
of my favorite stories.
You have to be tenacious if you're a gardener.
I like that story, too, because it's urban.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people
right.
think you have to have a lot of acreage
no.
to be able to make it. And she was doing, Silver Lake is right on the outskirts of L.A., right?
Absolutely. It was a little slice of land. And It's great now. Actually, some friends of hers who are landowners in Glassville Park, which is like the next neighborhood over, have invited her to just use their unused, to grow on their unused acres. So she's actually expanding thanks to some, you know, generous supporters.
Right. So give us, in your Slow Flowers book, you give us a definition of an old-fashioned florist, mm-hmm. someone in the business of raising and or selling flowers and ornamental plants. Now, most florists, as we know, are engaged exclusively in the selling and not so much in the raising. So, but you're really helping to change that. Tell us about your work with that.
Well, I don't know if you guys remember this. When I was a little kid, there was always a greenhouse attached to the flower shop in town.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
There was little, yeah. I don't know, people were growing all
right.
kinds of stuff.
Absolutely.
So I can't really take credit for this wonderful return to the old-fashioned definition, but I call the phenomenon the farmer florist. And we're witnessing this positive change from both sides. There are floral designers who right now are growing their own flowers, and it's out of a desire to have the most unique varieties, mm-hmm. to cut overhead.
Mm-hmm.
Right in New York City, there's people like Sarah Ryanen of Saipua. Well, she's in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Ariella Shazar, who has a new shop in New York City. They both have upstate farms where they're growing a lot of their, you know, beautiful foliage and flowers and branches.
Yeah.
And then Debbie DeMars, who's also in Brooklyn, she has a business called NYC Farm Chick Flowers. She's growing in her little brownstone backyard in Brooklyn. So that's kind of happening on the florist side. And then on the farmer side, there are farmers who are being drawn into the world of floral design because their clients are asking for it, and people want that farm fresh bouquet either, you know, at their wedding or their anniversary or their special event, and they want it to come from the farm, so they're expecting the farmers to offer design services.
It's kind of cool, it's happening
on both sides.
It is really cool. Actually, one of our head gardeners was involved. Her best friend was getting married this summer, and she helped do the flowers because, of course, she's a gardener and she, you know, knows how to work with them. But she contacted and contracted with a local rooftop farm here called The Grange, which is very connected with Heritage, and they're a huge rooftop farm, and they supply a lot of fruits and veggies to the local restaurants and to, you know, farmers markets and stuff, and they now are in the flower business as well, and they're contracting for wedding flowers. So,
I've got to get them on my site.
Yeah.
Also want to mention Molly Oliver Culver. She's in Brooklyn, and she is doing a lot of growing and weddings using New York grown flowers. So there's all kinds of really, you know, people are innovative.
I actually read an amazing book, and I'm sorry, I can't think of the title of it right now, but it was the story of a Brooklyn couple.
Yes.
And they, do you remember the name?
Something
of
Dirt, right? Something
Stronger Than Dirt.
Stronger Than Dirt.
And it was this, it was several years ago. They wrote this, they were in their like Brooklyn brownstone. They had two kids and trying to figure out, you know, what they were doing in Brooklyn like the rest of us. And he stopped at the farmer's market and bought a vase of flowers. And it was summertime, and, you know, he brought them home, and he kind of artfully arranged them in the little jar. And the wife came home and didn't really think too much about it, but the husband just kept staring and was like, this is our ticket out. Like, we need to do this. So the whole story is them moving upstate, kind of how they moved upstate, what it was like, and now they're huge farmers at the flower market, and all they sell are cuts.
I got to find that book. That sounds wonderful.
Stronger Than Dirt. It's hilarious to read.
Oh, wow. There. Well, it is. I mean, that's the other thing, is that flower farming has been romanticized, and I have to confess that because I write for Country Gardens magazine, every flower farmer story we publish is, it's beautiful, you know, it's this idyllic life, you know, captured by the camera. And the camera doesn't show the, you know, 14-hour days and the, you know,
and sunburned,
dirt on your fingernails.
Right, sunburned, bee stung, you know.
Exactly, it's just like landscaping, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, people do think we have a sort of tiptoe through the tulips kind of life. Like, it's all so very, it's pretty dirty and...
And how many boxes of Epsom salts are we like, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we have to take a break, Deborah. Hold on to the line. We'll be back in a few minutes to finish talking with you. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
You are listening to Lung by Iggy Dean on the heritageradionetwork.org. Stay tuned for more from We Dig Plants. The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants. I think I want a room at the Tabard Inn.
I want to listen to more of that music.
That was great. We are here with Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers. Deborah, let's get into the book.
Great.
It's a great book. I was inspired by the variety of arrangements that you made. You kind of gave yourself a challenge of making an arrangement a week for 52 weeks, right?
That's right.
Using only what was available. So tell us about that process and some of the challenges of doing that.
Well, what inspired this project was an editor in New York City, not to pick on New York, but who said to me, "That's fine if you live in Santa Barbara or something. Of course you can have flowers year-round, but the Korean deli on the Upper West Side where I live doesn't have local seasonal flowers, so it must not be mainstream." And I was dismissed on that subject. I thought, fine, I'll show her, and I just decided to make a bouquet every week for a year, using what was in my own garden here in Seattle or what I could procure from a local flower farmer. And, you know, when you gave the statistics at the top of the show,
yes,
Washington State is number 2 behind California, although it only accounts for 6% of, you know, domestic flower sales. We still have a lot of farmers here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, when I look back at it, I think, why did I start this project November 1st? I mean,
That's the worst, right?
So I basically had conifers and twigs, and that was it.
I was going to say, buds, anybody?
I can relate to that, Deborah, because I got married in November, you know, and it was 20-plus years ago. And I wanted a wintry kind of wedding, and I wasn't thinking about the flowers.
Which, yeah, I know, exactly.
It was interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, after sticking to my commitment all winter long, of course, spring finally arrived, and it was a breeze to finish this project. But to get through the winter, I had to create some cheats, and I'll give them to you and your listeners, and you have permission to use these. Okay. One is using greenhouse-grown flowers from local farmers. I have an amazing grower in Portland, Oregon, Peter Court, and they grow roses, hybrid tea roses, and lilies.
Wow.
For the floral trade. They're in the 50-mile bouquet. They were constantly, you know, useful to me. But I used houseplants. I cut up Rex begonia foliage all the time.
Yeah.
I used forest bulbs, amaryllis, and paper whites. And I also used just a lot of dried products, seed heads, rose hips, grasses. So, you know, anyone could do that. And for me, you don't even have to be trained in design. It's just like working in the garden and putting a composition together. You know, a little moment in the vase is like a little moment in the garden.
Right.
I know.
Right.
And speaking of the vase, you have quite a nice collection of pottery, Deborah. I noticed. I was having some major
vase envy.
Vase envy. I have, because I like that old 50s and 60s stuff, that Hager, you know, that.
Yeah,
like,
McCoy.
And that was a big part of it, too. I mean, how does your process work? Do you sort of pick the vase first, or do you, you know, tell me about that.
Well, you know, either way. I mean, sometimes I would have just gone to the flea market and bought an amazing McCoy vase for, like, you know, $2 or something.
Yeah.
You know, it was chipped or whatever, but I got a good price. And I'd say, what can I put in this beautiful, like, the glazes are so, they're like faded robin's egg, you know. Or I would say, oh, my gosh, my forsythia is in bloom. I better find something that looks great with garish yellow. And, you know, it goes either way.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did feel that, you know, if I was focusing on American-grown flowers, I really should focus on American vessels and pottery, and that gave me an excellent excuse to shop eBay every week and tell my husband it was for the book.
No, it's work, really. It's work.
It's research.
Yeah. That's what I say when I bring books home.
Oh, I know. It's an addiction.
So another great thing in your book is that you kind of have a recipe for each arrangement, and you include the list of growers for each plant or flower. And it was kind of like a restaurant menu listing the sources of the ingredients. Do you think the public is ready to embrace this movement towards American grown with flowers?
Oh, absolutely. I just think the public is so curious, and yet the labeling of flower origins has never been required, as
right.
it is with produce, fruits, vegetables. You also see it happening with seafood.
Uh-huh.
So in the past few years, many farmers and florists have begun to voluntarily label their flowers, and then that helps tell the story of who they are, and then that influences the restaurant
right.
you know, menu writer.
Right.
And I really, when I talk, and you guys use a statistic of 64% of cut flowers sold in the U.S. are imported. My research has been more like 80%.
Yeah, that's probably,
And I think people find this appalling when they hear it, that these are perishable products. Why are we using hundreds of jumbo jets per week to bring them to our stores?
Yeah. Well, and also, don't a lot of them go to the Amsterdam flower market and then they come back here too, some of them?
Yes, or they go to Miami and they truck them to you in New York.
Right.
And I just think the people who understand this the most are gardeners, because
right.
that's a paradox. And gardening is so much about place and climate and season. And somehow the floral industry has been disconnected with those sentiments. So I think people are really ready for it. I'm just pushing the dialogue, and being on this show and helping to talk about it maybe it'll prompt someone to just ask their,
florist.
Local supermarket, where did these come from?
Right.
And who grew them?
Right. Well, it's so important, because I think we are so far removed from our food, from agriculture, just as a society. So I think it's really important to have those stories out there. There was a hilarious parody on that show Portlandia in their first season about the chicken.
I didn't see that.
Where did it come from and how does it spend its day? And we need to go check where the chicken came from, and they leave the waiter hanging, and it's very funny.
I know it's completely
absurd, but the point is these are questions that we need to ask.
But the consumer likes to ask how much things cost.
Yeah,
so we
right.
have to ask. We have to talk dollars and cents too. We have gotten used to cheap food in this country relative to Europe and other industrialized nations.
Uh-huh.
We pay very little for our food, and we pay very little for our flowers.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you, how much of a price difference have you found, Deborah, for example, and I know it's comparing apples and oranges, so to speak, because they're not the same thing, but a price of a dozen locally grown roses versus a bunch of a dozen, roses brought in from South America. And I know the local roses will be probably fragrant and more beautiful, but what's the expectation there? What's the price range that you found?
Well, you guys had emailed me this question, so I thought I would do a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
In general, the price for roses everywhere is inflated at Valentine's Day.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah.
There is often a premium for American-grown flowers, especially roses, and that's because the farms have to meet all U.S. environmental and labor regs.
Yeah.
It's more like a couture crop versus a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
But I went online, and 1-800-Flowers and other sites like that are offering one dozen South American roses for $49.99.
Right.
There's a site that I've been promoting that's called CaliforniaBlooms.com. They're shipping direct from the farm, one dozen American-grown roses,
$49.99. Wow.
Which would you rather have?
Yeah.
Right.
What was the name of that site again?
It's California Blooms, plural. And they are the retail arm of a rose farm called Eufloria. And Eufloria's flowers are sublime. And they have about five different types of reds offered, but they have pinks and whites and,
Of
course,
that's amazing. I was expecting like double.
Yeah,
what you see with these these online services, are they upselling you to spend, you know, more to get the, you know, the crystal cut vase or, you know, the box of chocolates with it?
Or the long stem big box, yeah.
Right, exactly. Another place I like to recommend, especially because in cold areas, of course, it is hard to get fresh flowers that are locally grown, CaliforniaOrganicFlowers.com is a little farm in Chico, California. They have their certified organic 3-acre farm, and they supply... I call them the anti-FTD. So they're shipping, if you can't find local flowers, they're shipping bouquets. And right now, they don't have roses, but they have 24 stems of organic mixed anemones. And those anemones are like fuchsia and purple and deep red and those with those black centers, like luscious. And those are this week $45.95.
Wow.
And it's two dozen. So, you know.
And I'd rather have anemones than red roses any day, you know?
Exactly. I mean, that's the other thing that's happening in the whole Valentine's world is people want an alternative to roses.
Yeah.
They're looking for that. So,
yeah. Well, and David Austin Roses now is selling local bouquets, too.
Well,
out
you know
of
what?
Texas,
they just suspended their cut flower business. I don't know why. They still have it in the UK, but they dropped it in the US last fall.
Oh.
There is a wholesale grower in California called Green Valley Floral, and they're growing the David Austins for the wholesale trade, but nobody's doing retail anymore, which is really too bad. It's tragic.
Yeah, they were really kind of trying to get on the wedding bandwagon, too. And they were, like, you could just kind of design your floral bouquets on your own, and then they would send them off to you.
And weddings is where people will pay a premium for cut flowers. Maybe the flowers that you're bringing to your home weekly or bi-weekly, you may be a little more cautious about spending, you know, premium for. But if you're, when you're having your wedding or some other special occasion, that's when you're going to drop,
big bucks.
And that's where I think American growers can really do well. Mm-hmm. I think they were focusing on that, on weddings and events. And, you know, like our White House should be filled with American grown flowers, you know?
Dan, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't stop my call waiting before you guys called me. I'm sorry. But say that again. The White House should what?
I was saying the White House should be filled with American-grown flowers. You know,
absolutely. I am totally behind that idea. I mean, well, that's another conversation.
I was going to say, okay. Well, let's talk about Alaska.
Yes.
As part of the United States.
A little far removed, but still part of us.
Yeah, I guess they're big in the peony industry. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. And I could tell you were a little skeptical about that.
Yeah.
but here's my aunt. Because when I went up to Alaska to report on the peony growers there last summer, my friends were like, okay, that's not the 50-mile bouquet. That's like the 1,500-mile bouquet.
Right.
And I, you know.
And Russia's right next door. No, I'm just kidding.
I believe in supporting American flower farmers no matter where they are. And actually, there are flower farms in all 50 states thanks to the fact that Alaska has just begun growing peonies. There's about 150 intrepid small family farms. It's literally the only agricultural export crop from that state.
Wow.
It's oil or fish, both of which do not smell as good as the peonies.
Wow.
But the thing about Alaska peonies, that the real magic is that those flowers are harvested in July and August and even into early September, well after peonies have finished blooming in the lower 48. June, maybe?
June.
Early June?
Late May, early June, yeah.
Right. So they're not competing with anyone else on the planet. They are the only place on the planet in that July-August window, which, of course, is when most brides are demanding peonies in their bouquets.
Right.
And so I'm behind this because, yes, there's a carbon footprint, but I interviewed Dr. Pat Holloway of University of Alaska at Fairbanks. She's the main primary researcher of the peony industry.
Mm-hmm.
And she points out those empty airplanes are leaving the state anyway, so isn't it great that we can put some lightweight product on that helps stimulate economic development in rural Alaska?
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty cool.
That's really cool.
Those farmers are selling their stems for like $3.50 to $4 per stem.
Wow.
Wholesale.
Wow.
So it's helping.
And they have plenty of sunshine there in summer.
And the cool temperatures. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just mind-blowing. But I'm encouraging it because I feel like they're not putting anybody else out of business. They're filling a niche that is that's definitely a demand. So.
It's the old idea of the ballast, you know, in the boat.
Right.
That's great. So tell us about slowflowers.com and your campaign on Indiegogo.
Well, thank you for asking. I mean, this what I'm really hoping to accomplish with the slowflowers.com website, which is sort of a play on the book name, is that every time someone wants to give or send or purchase flowers, they stop and say, can I buy American grown? And the Slow Flowers site will help them navigate that search. It's really going to just identify who are the florists, the farmers, the designers, the retailers who are sourcing American grown, especially local in their own area, but say if it's out of season, maybe they're going to be getting California grown.
Right.
So the site's about ready to launch. I ran out of money, and so I spent about $15,000 of my own money to launch the site. And, you know, we're
right.
not done yet. So
right.
some friends have been, and the cost is really building this database with all the wonderful features like video, photo galleries, links, Yelp-style reviews. I mean, anybody who's going to order through this site, I want them to have the ability to give a positive or a negative review of that experience.
Oh, so you can order through the site then? It's not like it's not just a directory.
No, I'm not doing e-commerce. What I mean is, I'm not taking a penny out of any of these transactions, but I'm just pointing you. So if you have your mother-in-law lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and you don't
right.
want to use a toll-free, you can go put in her zip code and find who the florists are in Milwaukee or the farmers, because a lot of farmers do farm direct, and then you'll contact them through the website or their phone number, make the
yeah.
a transaction.
Okay.
But then if it's positive, you'll put a review on there,
okay.
hopefully.
Good.
Right. See, I was doing something kind of like that. Whenever I send flowers, I always try to call the florist directly.
That's
you know?
What I do, yeah.
Because I feel like
I just look it up online.
Yeah. I look up the local florist that's nearby. I try to give the business, because I know, having worked, my first job in horticulture was at a big New York florist.
Oh, wow.
And I know that they don't make much money on those FTD things,
no.
on those deals.
No.
Some of them are losing money.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
In some instances. But they have to be part of the network, you know. So it's really wonderful to be making a new network. You know,
I
an alternative
so. I really,
network.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it really is creating community, because people, there are florists on the site who say, I'm so glad you're listing farmers, because I need to find farmers to buy from.
Right.
And the farmers are thrilled that they might have, you know, an excess of, you know, particular crop, and wow, the next city over, there's someone who wants to buy it now at
right.
the flower shop.
Right.
So we're pretty close. With the campaign on Indiegogo ends February 19th, and my original goal was 12,000. I think we're going to be more like 16,000, which
awesome.
Yeah, pretty sweet. And
well, I'm going to go on that tonight when I get home and contribute to you,
yes.
because it's brilliant.
Oh, thanks. Well, the cool thing is all that money is going to pay my developers, and then to do a big, I'm probably going to do a big Mother's Day promotion, because
right.
We'll be ready to launch then. And my ultimate goal is to have 1,000 members listed on the site. We'll probably, in all 50 states, we'll probably launch with about 300
right.
Resources.
Right.
And we
so.
Need, you know, the thing about the cut flower business too, if it's local, is if a local farmer is growing organic already or growing various crops on his farm, it's such a natural addition to add cut flowers to it. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's just another
yeah.
source of revenue. That,
right.
you know, or if one crop fails, or if he doesn't do well with one thing, the flowers can offset that, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting you say that. I have a podcast that I'm doing to interview flower farmers and florists, and I just interviewed a farmer yesterday for a show next month, and she started adding flowers to her farm to create a way to attract pollinators. It was nothing more than that. She
wow.
wanted biodiversity.
Right.
And all of a sudden, she realized that it's a value-added crop.
Yeah.
I said to her, probably more than carrots. She goes, well, not my carrots, because I have rainbow carrots.
But it is
exciting.
You will pay more for something
yeah.
like that. You know?
Well, Deborah, I've got a connection for you. My cousin in Tennessee is a zinnia grower.
All
and
right.
And he's already in all the local Tennessee markets.
Good. I want to talk to him.
Yeah, so I will connect you too, because I think this will be great. And, you know, he and his wife are very connected with local Grow Tennessee products. That's their whole initiative.
Well, that's the other thing about, you know, every state now has one of those, you know,
yeah.
Commodity or, you know, ag promotion campaigns.
Yeah.
Flowers are starting to come into that world.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. And that's where the consumer already gets it.
Yes.
So
Are there any government subsidies for flower growing?
The only subsidies that I've been able to come across are through USDA specialty crop block grants, mm-hmm. and those are administered, you know, state by state, at the state level, but the USDA gives, like, every state, you know, their own chunk of money. But, for example, you said that I was on the board of the Seattle Wholesale Growers Market. This is a farmer-to-florist cooperative based in Seattle. It involves about 20 farmers in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, and they got a two-state block grant to promote a supermarket mixed bouquet program.
Oh, awesome.
And so that was like $113,000 to develop packaging and messaging and to hire a floral merchandiser. And, you know, there's that kind of money.
Right.
But what there isn't, and what Congress has never done, is mitigate the pain and suffering that the American flower farmers are feeling.
Like the corn industry, right?
Right, because of all the free tariffs that are, you know, the tariff-free flowers that are flowing in from South America.
Right.
So that's kind of sucks.
That's sad.
But the farmers are intrepid, like we said earlier, and they love their land.
Yeah.
And they love living off the land, and they know flowers are, you know, a possibility for making a decent living.
When I got married, I got married at the Museum of Appalachia down in Tennessee, and my friend, who was a landscape contractor, he did all my flowers for me, and we went to the local flower market, you know, the day before the wedding, and pulled what we could. And I said, this was a May wedding, so I said to the rep at the flower market, I said, "Do you guys have any Lily of the Valley?" And he said, "Oh no, oh, that's too expensive. Nobody." And I was like, "It is a weed, and you could be making so much money. It's a wedding flower."
It's so true. It's so funny that in the big crop here on from San Francisco up to Seattle, everybody wants Queen Anne's lace, and most people are like, "I think that's Rhodesia, but sure, we'll grow it," you know, and it's cherished because it's so fragile and ephemeral and old-fashioned, but now farmers are throwing it rows of it.
Oh, I know. I just bought some, and we gave some to some of our select clients, and then I planted some at my parents' house.
Yeah,
it's a great flower.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of like the alternative to baby's breath, although that's hot again, too, which is crazy.
Is it really?
Yeah, and everything from the 70s is back.
Mm-hmm. So we're coming to the end, unfortunately,
yeah, sure.
Deborah. The 45 minutes always passes so quickly. So I have to ask you, you know, Valentine's Day is only 4 days away. People always wait till the last possible minute, especially men. And I experienced this firsthand working in the florist.
No blue-dyed flowers.
No blue-dyed flowers, please.
Oh, my goodness.
So where can people still mail order if, you know, and choose ethically and choose slow flowers now, today?
I think they can. I mean, it takes a little more work. I mentioned those sites. I'm going to put some links up on deborahprinzing.com. And so I actually have a list of about 80 or 90 people who've already signed on to the Slow Flower site that I'll put up there for you.
Oh, good.
But the other thing is, you know, there are other cool options. I've been encouraging people to find a flower farmer in their area and pre-order a seasonal bouquet for when the flowers are at their peak. So you're giving a gift certificate for a summer bouquet as a Valentine's
Day.
That's
a really good idea.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Yeah,
and
then, you know, you mentioned dahlias. I mean, a case of dahlia tubers, if my husband would figure it out, that's what I really want.
Yeah, yeah.
Or seed packets of heirloom and edible flowers. I mean, that, you know, for a gardener, that's a great Valentine's Day gift. But it's not too late to get flowers. I think it's kind of an artificial week to give flowers.
Yes.
So, you know, orchids, houseplants, flowering branches, you know, those are also widely available.
I love
those.
I love the cherry blossoms, plum.
Yeah, bring it in. We all need it, you know.
befriend an arborist and get your own free branches.
That's right.
I just bought for myself, because winter has been very long and snowy here in the Northeast, I bought some hyacinths. I had to.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah, we're on our fifth fifth installment of tulips. Yeah.
Oh, you guys. Well, yeah. I think you're both kind of dancing back into the flower production. By the time we're done now,
yeah.
I convinced you to become flower farmers.
If we just had some land. Well, we have rooftops. We have rooftops. Yeah. So.
Well, we can encourage our clients to. We always try to put some cuts into people's gardens that we create. In fact, one of our clients who is very dear to us has been a client for more than 10 years. She wants her garden
she
is all
wants,
about picking,
yeah.
all about picking, and that's mm-hmm.
and
all,
every week.
Yeah.
That's what she, you know. So we have to really pay attention to the the bloom times.
Yes,
sure.
So that she is
has
not disappointed.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and she's great.
Oh,
you know,
that's beautiful.
It's very fun to make sure that she has a weekly arrangement.
Yeah.
Oh, that's like a nostalgic practice that she's bringing into the modern lifestyle.
Yes,
I love that.
Absolutely.
And it's all in containers on a Manhattan rooftop.
Yeah.
So it's pretty fun.
Wow. Well, I'm inspired. I'm going to come invite myself to see that garden when I'm in New York.
Please do. Please look us up next time you're here. We'd love to meet you.
Thank you so much. I've just really enjoyed being on the show with you. I listen to you on my, download, so it's nice to be live.
Oh, good.
Good.
Thanks.
Well, thanks for being on the show. Happy Valentine's Day. You've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network and We Dig Plants. Special thanks go out to our sponsor. Our show has been produced by Jack Inslee and engineered by Joe G. Remember to join our Facebook fan page. Stay current on our projects, our upcoming shows, and you can also win free stuff. Thanks for listening.
See you in the garden.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.